Good evening. How's everybody this evening? Doing? Good. It's kind of different today with the fog and the drizzle. It just felt a little out of place. I don't know. I guess it was a reminder that fall starts, what, tomorrow, is it? Maybe? And that means that somebody told me one time, fall is my favorite time of year, except I know winter's coming. And I kind of feel like that sometimes, but you know what? I'm learning to enjoy winter more and more. I'm still working on February, but other than that. All right, well, I'm glad that you're here tonight as we kind of pause in the middle of the week and take another opportunity for many of us to get into the Word of God and to study. And we've been so blessed to be able to explore the book of Daniel these past three Wednesday nights. And we want to continue that study tonight with Daniel chapter 3. And last week was a bit of a challenge personally for me teaching, because there's just so much to grasp. And as it turns out, it was a bit of a warm-up for this week. So Daniel chapter 3 is one of these chapters that is a bit of a paradox in our Bible. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that Daniel chapter 3 has oftentimes been reduced to a children's story. And sometimes because of that, we're not encouraged or invited or inspired even to look further into Daniel chapter 3 and see what it's really about. Daniel chapter 3 is explosive, not only because there's a fiery furnace, but it's dangerous because it is so relevant to us today, 2,559 years later. It means as much as it did to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so because of that, and because, as you'll see in a minute, we're dealing with probably the third rail of polite discussions today, it's very difficult to teach and very challenging. But we're gonna begin. First of all, what I want to do in Daniel chapter 3, and most of us are familiar with the chapter, it's the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the fiery furnace. And we've probably told that to our children and read it in our children's storybooks and seen it on VeggieTales and all of that. And that's good. It's a good story for our young people to understand. But at the end of the day, Daniel chapter 3 is an expose, really, on how a nation can exalt its power, exalt its national security, and even its economy as though it were God, and then force people to give their allegiance to that as if it was divine. And it raises a lot of questions. And if that doesn't sound like uncomfortably familiar to you today, if it does, yeah, me too. And if it doesn't, it might by the end of our class time tonight. And again, it raises a lot of questions. I mean, you think about, can patriotism become idolatry? Can the dreams of a one world order become idolatry? All of those things that we're so used to seeing. And it really causes us, and it causes throughout history, nations to ask themselves some questions. How do we know as a nation when we're going too far? And there are certain signs that we can look for that are shown in Daniel chapter 3 that tell us that as a nation, we need to put up those guardrails again and not go that far. And we're going to see in this chapter how when things like when a nation decides that it needs to cheapen the sanctity of life, it can cause bad things to happen. And that can take a lot of forms. It can take the forms of ethnic cleansing or mass executions or abortion. It could take the form of legalized suicide, assisted suicide. It can take a lot of forms. But when we begin to cheapen life, that's a sign that, yeah, as a group of people, as a community, as a nation, as a tribe, we're going too far. And we need to get back. And another one is probably that the authority of God is being replaced by the authority of man or the authority of a creed. Something that was created by man and represents God. That's a danger sign. And because of that, things like morals and what's right and what's wrong become very blurred and become on a sliding scale. All of these things were in operation during the time of Babylon. That's kind of where I'm going with that. They were in operation before Babylon. Okay? The nation of Israel had these very, very problems. And throughout human history, I think we've had these problems. So as we look at this story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the fiery furnace, and the fourth one who's in there, which we'll talk about in a minute, we will see how these things manifest themselves in God's kingdom and what God's kingdom looks like compared to man's kingdom. So as we look at chapter 3 and we think about this, and we recognize that it's really not just a children's story, but it is an expose on the dangers, the horrors, consequences of when human kingdoms exalt themselves and stamp themselves with their own divine authority. Okay? Their own divine authority. A divine authority that they devise themselves. And it challenges our thinking on things like nationalism, patriotism, and all of the pitfalls that can happen there. So I beg you not to jump too far ahead in what I'm saying here tonight. And again, like I said, this is really hard. Because it sounds like I might be saying something that I'm not saying, or I left something unsaid, and I apologize in advance for that. So I'm going to do my best, and with God's help, we can get through this tonight and kind of figure out how Daniel 3 fits into all of this. So as just a 30-second review, of course, Daniel and his three friends and several hundred thousand, perhaps millions of others, were taken captive to Babylon from their home in God's promised land of Israel. And Jerusalem was in the process of being destroyed the first time, and they find themselves exiled in a foreign land. And they find themselves adjusting to a new culture far, far away. And Daniel and his friends and many of the exiles, the struggle is to remain faithful. And we've talked about that the last couple of weeks, how when you get into that river, and the river represents culture that's flowing. And as you try to navigate yourself from one riverbank to the other riverbank, it's very easy just to give up and flow with the current, which is where culture wants to take you. It takes effort to swim against it. It takes effort. It takes purpose. It takes intention to swim against the culture of what mankind's devices can do to us as Christians. And that's where they were in Babylon. They were in that very same situation, and we are in that situation today. I hope you see that. I hope you understand that today we're in that very, very same situation. It's a struggle to remain faithful. That's our story today. That was the story of Daniel, and it's really been the story of Christians for centuries. So this is a well-known Bible story. We've heard it through our books and talking vegetables and those. We had a cardboard children's cutout book that you open up and there's these flames that come up and there's Daniel. And when I was a kid, I remember that pop-up book. And the moral of the story when I was a kid was a good one, very much. It's obey God no matter what at any cost. Always obey God. And there's that's you can't go wrong with that. But can you see how it just might be... It doesn't quite wrap up all the stories we become adults of what it's all about. We just dismiss that as, okay, I've got that story figured out. It's in a box. It's over there. And I don't really go back to revisit it very often. And you see how it robs it of its power, and that's what we want to do. This is not child's play at all. It's a very, very, very explosive story. So, one of the reasons why it makes it uncomfortable for me is because, again, it delves into the two topics that in polite conversation that you try to avoid. And what are those two topics? Politics and religion, right? Okay? And it's like at Thanksgiving dinner and the families together, we've become more and more likely to avoid the topic of politics, especially. Maybe you too. Religion, a little, but not so much. You know, religion is pretty much okay. But if you are taking coffee break with your coworkers, or you're with friends at school, you know, in between classes or whatever, and this is one of those topics, these are two of the topics that you typically try not to bring up. Because if you do, you're just kind of looking for a fight. Okay? Politics and religion, and it's a different kind of fiery furnace that you get into. But Daniel chapter 3 tackles this head on. And it needs to inspire us as Christians to be able to tackle politics and religion head on. And to see what the Bible says about how they exist together. So it's very, very important. So welcome to Daniel chapter 3. Now, I want to ask you, you probably know who the guy is on the left side of the screen, or right, it's the left side of the screen. Who is that? Adolf Hitler. What about the guy on the right hand? Now, if you know your German history in the 20th century, maybe you know this guy. He's fairly obscure. Anybody want to take a crack at it? What's that? No. That's a good guess, though. I mean, yeah. No. The guy's name is Balder. Balder van Schirach. Now, Balder, when he was 10 years old, he joined the Nazi Party. And as he became a teenager, it was clear that he was going to be the model Aryan youth. He was going to be the ideal young German boy. The poster child for the Übermensch, you know, the ultimate master race. He was going to be the guy. By the time he was 24 years old, he had founded a movement called Hitler Youth. And he had organized teaching in all of the schools. And teachers were given the curriculum that you teach about the Nazi Party. And you bring up your children in the knowledge of the Aryan race and the superiority of the race. And as the head and founder of Hitler Youth, he did such a good job that Hitler elevated him to a position of national secretary later in his life. He gave an interview before World War II, when things were just kind of heating up in Germany a little bit with the Nazi Party. He gave an interview to London Times. And at the very end of the interview, he concluded with these words. And he said this: one cannot be a good German and at the same time deny God. But an arousal of faith in the eternal German, the Übermensch, is at the same time an arousal of faith in the eternal God. If we act as true Germans, we act according to the laws of God. Whoever serves Adolf Hitler, the Führer, serves Germany, and whoever serves Germany serves God. Tell us what you really think, Balder, right? Does anybody find that a little chilling? Yeah. Yeah, I do too. You know, it gets kind of quiet when we see that because we cringe on the inside. Because we know the story. We know what happened less than 10 years later. Millions of people were dead in World War II after this had happened. After something horrible had gone wrong. As a tribe or a nation, Germany, you know, their values and their culture, their state religion and their ideology was all elevated up to heaven and somehow stamped with the authority of God. And they marched forth with that very same view of the world and of themselves, really. And it was their job to subdue the opposition. That kind of idolatry, really, of national identity leads to horror in the world. And you can see that. They felt as if they were appointed by God Himself to save the world from inferior people. And you see the danger that happens there. This is exactly the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar felt in Babylon in 595 BC. Same thing. And things go horribly wrong when we as humans abuse what God has granted us and elevate our nationality with a stamp of deity. And if you notice how he says this, if you serve God, whoever serves Adolf Hitler, the Führer, serves Germany, and whoever serves Germany serves God. Now, who's in fourth place in that race? Yeah. Yeah, I think they're kind of using God as their excuse. So this is what Daniel 3 is all about. So it's that expose of what happens when human idolatry and national identity collide, and it just it doesn't work well. Throughout history, since the time that we were created, humans have gathered together in nations, and we seek security and safety with one another. We share our resources, and we have a need to have to govern ourselves. It's just the way it is. But something unique happens when a tribe or a country or a nation begins to elevate their way of life and stamp it with that made-up divine authority, and everybody else needs to recognize it too. And Germany certainly wasn't the first one to do it, and they won't be the last, and they haven't been the last to do that. So that's where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego find themselves in Daniel chapter 3, and really God's covenant people, who are all of us, find ourselves living in a nation that is going down a path. And how do we live in that situation, and what should we do? And maybe that nation doesn't quite go down the path that Germany did, or didn't quite go down the path that Babylon did. But it goes down a path that is on the way to nationalizing its national identity in ways that God did not intend. So welcome to Daniel chapter 3. It's not a children's story. Okay. So if you have your Bibles, I'd like you to turn to Daniel chapter 3. Power them up, turn your pages, however you get to it. And we'll begin reading. Before we start, are there any thoughts or comments? And I've got to do a better job of pausing and letting people react. So I'm sorry if I haven't been very good at that. Yes, Silas. Interesting. Fiji. Wow. I know Fiji water. I see that in the convenience store. Maybe that's what did it. I don't know. Any other thoughts? Huh. It's a never-ending story, right? It really is. Okay. All right. Let's go up. King Nebuchadnezzar, chapter 3, verse 1. Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Does your Bible have anything other than cubits? Because when I was a kid, the fun thing about my Bible was always in the back, where I could look at the pictures and the tables and measures, right? So what does it say? New International Version. Okay. There you go. Yeah, that's loosely translated. Is that what you had, Dave? Yeah. About 90 feet high. I did a little graphic because I thought, okay, what did this statue, and it's on the plain of Dura, so you could see it for miles probably. You know, it's on a flat plain. So what I did was I thought about the church building and how tall it was from the sidewalk outside to the top of the roof out there. And I'm guessing, Jim, you would know, maybe 30 feet from the sidewalk to the pitch to the top of the roof, give or take. Maybe a little bit less. So I did this representation of the statue. And mind you, this is an image, or it doesn't say if it was a man or if it was an obelisk. We don't know. Most representations of this are some form of a man. But if you put it next to our church building, it would be about like that. So it was a massive statue, right? It was made of probably plated gold, not solid gold. But for a king to put resources and manpower into doing something like that, the guy had to be a little bit off his rocker, maybe. But if you think about it, back in those days, when you think of the ancient wonders of the world and you look at like the Colossus of Rhodes, that was a bigger statue than Nebuchadnezzar's was. And the people of the day, when they heard about Nebuchadnezzar and they said, oh, he's just one of those kings that likes to build the big statues, you know, in these ancient times, that's the way these kings were. To impress their people, to cause them to be in awe of them, to make elevate themselves to be like God. They build these massive statues like that. And thank goodness that we have evolved beyond that as human beings today. I'm so glad. That happens to be a statue of Lenin in Leningrad, one of the, I believe, founders of the modern communism movement. This was taken in Baghdad, and you probably know who this guy is, Saddam Hussein. This was moments before the soldiers ripped it apart back in the 1990s. What's that? 2003. Thank you. That's right. That's after they killed him. I was thinking the war was back then. It started back in 91, I think. Yeah. Were you there? Oh, okay. Near right. Yeah, I'm really glad that we don't do this today. Oops. Oh, okay. This was the gift, so how could we refuse this? The Statue of Liberty is bigger than any of those statues, okay? But here's the thing. As a country, we're not commanded to bow down and worship the Statue of Liberty, obviously. We're not. We're not. And if this was George Clooney, it might have a different meaning. I don't know. Right? But think about it, what it stands for and what it represents. And that's, I mean, I've been there. You've probably been there too. You've seen this. And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of my country. I like what it represents, liberty, you know, and the freedom that comes from people who have been oppressed. You know, give us your tired and your poor or your huddled masses. But there have to be guardrails. There have to be guardrails there to where you can see massive things like this and elevate that beyond where it should be. And I'm thankful that God has given us this country. And we're going to talk about that in just a little while. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar is one of those kings. Verse 2. He then summoned the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the advisors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates. I mean, this is the list of everybody that's important. And all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the advisors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound," and then we have another list, "the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music," basically the orchestra. This is the whole nine yards. "When you hear the music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." So how are we doing so far? How are we doing? Right? Yeah, it gets a little dicey, doesn't it? So, as we set the stage for this story, none of the main characters really, except Nebuchadnezzar, have been introduced to this point yet. But we're talking about the most powerful empire on the planet. We're not talking about some fairy tale. We're talking about an empire that had power, that had exalted itself to the level of the gods. Their culture, their military might, their economy, their values, all of the world, it says, has to declare their allegiance to Babylon through this image of gold. And they had to come from wherever they were, they had to stop what they were doing, and they had to bow down and worship. And I don't think they were just singing praise songs. I think they were on penalty of death. They were having to give their allegiance. Now, who does that? Who does something like that? Somebody who says human life is not worth much. I can kill you if you don't. I'll kill you. It doesn't bother me. I'll kill you. Yeah. It's basically Nebuchadnezzar's way of saying Babylon will define your reality. Babylon will tell you what's right or wrong. Babylon will tell you if you're a success or a failure. Babylon is God, is what he's saying. And all of that was symbolized in this whatever it looked like image that was set on the plain of Dura that everybody had to bow down to. Now this is a powerful thing for humans to have to ingest and take in. Okay? It isn't a children's story. This is real life for these people. Babylon is reality. You know, last week, you remember we talked briefly about this, about how human kingdoms were represented by an image. Do you remember that? There was a clear allusion of this. Because Daniel chapter 3 follows Daniel chapter 2. Do you remember what was in Daniel chapter 2? The dream, right. Now, what did he dream of? A giant statue, right, that represented kingdoms of the earth that were flawed and that would be destroyed, put onto the ash heap of history compared to the kingdom of God. Maybe he said, I had that dream, I'll just do it. And chapter 3, he does it. Only feeling like the head of gold wasn't enough, the whole thing was made out of gold. And this represents my power and my authority and puts the stamp of divinity on my kingdom. I rule. Now, where else did we talk last week about human beings ruling? Do you remember? In Genesis chapter 1, what does Genesis chapter 1 tell us? We are created in the image of God. And you remember the word image? What it's tselem, which is the Hebrew word, which is a form of the word idol. Basically, we don't possess it, we are. Whether you know it or not, like it or not, want to be or not, you are the image of God. And what was human beings' job, according to Genesis chapter 1? To rule. Yeah, we had to rule over what God had created. So, here was God creating everything, and he was managing that creation through the image that he had created and said, I want you to rule over it. How? By loving one another, by loving God and loving your fellow man. And if everybody did that, I think there would be peace on earth. And I think God would see that his creation is being managed and ruled over perfectly. But unfortunately, we have many Adolf Hitlers and Nebuchadnezzars and Brian Leslies that do things their own way and screw it up. And we don't. We talked last week about how God created this creation with this massive potential. And he said, rule over it in ways that will release that for the good of man and the good of the planet and the good of creation. That's what love is. And that was our job to do. But as you see throughout history, when human beings are given the authority to rule, what often happens? The power goes to our head, right? What is the old saying we talked about last week? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Yeah, that's a pretty accurate axiom. So we don't image God in the ways that often God wants us to image him. But he still has chosen to partner with his images and rule the world through them. And we do that on his behalf in a perfect world. And we do, as Christians, the best we can. But you see, this image in Daniel chapter 3 sort of distorts that fabric of the universe. God's looking at it and saying, Nebuchadnezzar, not what I had in mind. Because people are treating the image of God as humans. Humans are worshiping it. Now, what is the problem when we do that? What did the Bible tell the Israelites about images and idols? There's no other. Yeah. You do not do that. Put nothing before me and make no graven image, make no idols. Because there's a couple of reasons for that, and I think we know that deep down in our hearts. We just kind of know that if you do that, you're taking a created thing to replace or treat as the creator. Okay? And it blurs the distinction between the creator and the created. And that reduces God to something less than he is. Simple. It's very simple. You see how that works? Doesn't take a rocket science to understand that. If you are creating something like this statue to worship as if it were God, you are reducing God to something less than he is. And God says, I've already made the idols. It's you. It's the people you're sitting next to tonight. It's you. I've already made enough of those. You don't need to make any more. Okay? It's working the way that I intended to do. That's all we need. But human beings, being who we are, we make idols and put them in place of God. And sometimes it can be a national identity, like it was with Germany, like it was with Babylon. And that's what chapter 3 is warning us against. This image disturbs the fabric of the universe. So you're not supposed to make images because it reduces God to less than what he is, and it's foolish to worship something that was created as if it was the creator. That's dumb. And we're not supposed to make image because God already did that in Genesis chapter 1. Okay? So I think we've established that. So it's extremely dangerous when we go down this path and when we mistake life that humans have created with God itself, and that's what they did. So let's read on. Okay, verses 8 through 12. Somebody read that for me. I'm reading way too much. David, would you read that for me, please, Dave?
For this reason, at the time when certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews, they responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar, the king, O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of the Babylon, named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you, and they do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up.
Okay, so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are ratted out by these astrologers. Come to them, and they're hoping that maybe they'll gain the favor of the king by showing how these people that you are expecting to be leaders in Babylon are not doing what you say. And they're violating the three things that you just don't want to violate in front of King Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? Note to self, again, if you're ever in front of King Nebuchadnezzar, first thing out of your mouth might be, oh, king, live forever. Okay? All right? So it shows you that these men are polite, if nothing else. I mean, and there are lots of things, but they're polite, right? But they violated the three things that make them a threat to Nebuchadnezzar. Number one, they don't honor you. They're rebellious. Number two, they don't honor your gods. They have no religion. And three, they don't honor your kingdom. They're not patriotic. Okay? This is according to Nebuchadnezzar. These are the rules that he set up, and they have violated all three of these things. That's the triumvirate, the unholy trinity, that makes them a threat, who otherwise they would have just been quietly going about their lives. but they were a threat. Let's read 13 through 15. Daniel, I think it's appropriate if I ask you. 13 through 15.
Nebuchadnezzar and furious rage commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "It is true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up. As you are ready when you hear the sound of horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made. Well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God will deliver you out of my hand?"
Okay. Yep, that's good. Clearly a man that's intoxicated with his own power. That's pretty easy to see. Nebuchadnezzar is a bit full of himself, right? Basically, he's telling these three teenage boys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and maybe they're 20, in their early 20s, the latest. He says, "I'm God to you. No God will rescue you. I hold your life in my hand." Now, how would you react in that situation? How do you react in that situation today when you're confronted with a person who says, and I was this week, "There is no God. Oh, I used to believe in the resurrection, but now I don't think I buy the whole story anymore. Oh, the Apostle Paul. Yeah, well, you know, he was a smart man and I've read all of his letters, but they're just letters. He missed the mark. I don't know that Jesus was really resurrected. I grew up thinking that in church. I had a conversation with somebody this week. How are you? How do you react to that? With silence? With a look on your face like I'm totally lost. I don't know what to say. Lord, please help me. That's kind of where I was. Or do you change the subject? You just kind of drift with the current a little. What do you do when you're standing in front of somebody who is accusing you or telling you that there is no God, I'm your God, or it's futile what you believe in, or just wake up and smell the coffee, you've really drunk the Kool-Aid on this one. What do you do? What do you do? What's that? You disagree with them, okay? Yeah. At some point, you've got to represent, right? Okay, I'm hoping that we get to that point here. And a little bit later in the story, we can talk about that. So I want to kind of move us ahead just a little bit. But you see the position where they were and how we can be in that same position today. Let's go with 19 through 23. Who would like to read 19 through 23? Deb, do you have that? Oh, let's let Bob read something. Go ahead, Bob. Okay. One thing that you notice at the beginning of there was Nebuchadnezzar was furious. The second time that he's furious. Yes, right. Did I really? Oh, thank you. I thought something was a little bit off. Go ahead and read that for us, Ryan. Thank you. Oh, okay. All right. So, you know, Liberta said, "Yeah, I disagree with them," right? And you're in that situation, you disagree, right? So this is the coolest answer ever. Have you ever thought about how this answer is just an awesome answer, right? They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, basically, they were very polite. And these guys are like, to me, they'd be way too nice. I'd be saying, you filthy pagan blasphemer, you infidel, don't you know that God is God? And, you know, I mean, just could, I don't know if I'd be brave enough to do that. But, I mean, you'd think that maybe they would have a little bit of, but they're very polite. They're basically saying this to King Nebuchadnezzar. They're saying, King, we don't believe your God. We never will. We don't need to have a theological discussion about this. It's the way it is. You can kill us if you want to. It doesn't mean anything to us. Our God will deliver us, and even if he doesn't, we'll still be free from you. Not a thing you can do with us. You're not God. That's basically what they're saying. How many times have you had to remind somebody, be it your children, or a friend, or somebody else, that you're not God? And they're very polite about it. We're not interested in having a debate with you. We just don't believe you're God. I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. No theology here. And if you're King Nebuchadnezzar, you're like, you could be so totally frustrated. Their resistance is peaceful, it's polite, but at the same time, the conviction and the trust that they had in God comes through in that massive amount of confidence and conviction that they have standing before this king who is the most powerful person on the planet at the time. And they say, you're not God. End of discussion. Do with us what you want. You're not God. How powerful is that? I mean, really. The thing that King Nebuchadnezzar thought that he could hold over their heads doesn't mean a thing to these men. Because they understood who God was. And you're not him. You're not it. So, they fundamentally disagreed with who you are. And not only that, with who Babylon is. Thomas.
I think it's just interesting to note as well that this is, you know, 10, 15, maybe not even years after they watched God let Israel be destroyed completely. So they've watched their own nationalistic country be destroyed. They're in the midst of a very nationalistic, patriotic, pagan society, and they're still going. God is God. No one else is. We still believe him. And so, I mean, it's interesting. Not only did their belief trump Babylon's nationalism,
yeah,
but even went above their own.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. That's a very, very good point. Their faith hadn't changed. This is faith in exile, folks. And some days I feel like, you know, maybe we're in exile a little bit some days. Faith in exile. Now, we read already 19 through 23, and we found out there that King Nebuchadnezzar became very furious. And I think I would probably be too. One of the things that I noticed in chapter, I think it's verse 19, was Nebuchadnezzar was furious with rage with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What am I going to do with you? Well, of course, I'm going to kill you, but I don't even know if that's going to solve anything, you know. His attitude toward them changed. Now, in the NIV, that's what it says. Does anybody else have something different in verse 19? Yes. And another form of that word, salam, which is the image or that idol form in the Hebrew word. Only in the Arabic, you could translate that as image. So, it's so ironic that Nebuchadnezzar created this image or this idol that was static and that never changed, and yet he couldn't even control his own image. What does that tell you? He's not God, is what it tells you. He has no control over his own attitude. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter. And if you don't think that fire was hot enough to kill a human for some reason, if you're a doubter, well, it killed the people that tried to throw him in the furnace. And that tells you something else about Nebuchadnezzar, right? It tells him he thought so little of human life that he would throw away human lives just to kill human lives. I mean, what kind of a person does that? That's pretty frightening. To think that your leader of your country has gotten to that point, that's pretty frightening. I'm sorry? Yes, 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 exactly. Yeah, he treated his dog better than his own son, which in a lot of cases was absolutely true, I believe. All right, so let's continue so we can maybe get through most of this. In verse 24 through 26, Silas, would you read 24 through 26, please? Okay, perfect. So they were thrown into the fiery furnace, what Bob read, and then they come out. Nebuchadnezzar sees there's four people in that fiery furnace. Now that was an eye-opener for him, first of all. And you can see again that his countenance changes. He leaped to his feet in amazement, which means something that was totally confusing to the most powerful person in the world. And how often do you read in the Bible that God is confused? Zero. You don't see that word in reference to Elohim at all. And here, Nebuchadnezzar, it's written that he had the countenance of somebody who was confused. He didn't know what to think. And he asked his advisors, of course, the guys are going to say, anything you say, king, yes, 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 yes. Weren't there three men in there when we threw? Yes, there were, yes, there were. He said, but I see four. They're unbound and unharmed. These men are walking freely. They're not bound by me. They weren't bound by anything I did. The ropes burned, but they didn't. I don't figure that out. And there's somebody else in there that doesn't look real human, but kind of looks human. Theologians have speculated that, hey, you know, and maybe it's kind of, you think that might have been the angel of the Lord. It might have been Jesus in there with him, symbolizing how the effects of our taking a stand might mean that we go into the fire, but Jesus is there with us. The Son of Man is in the flames when we're in the flames and delivers us. Doesn't deliver us from the furnace, but he delivers us from the effects, the lasting effects of that, the flame. And the amazing thing is, as we read further in 27, so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. The satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them, and they saw the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was even a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. All the senses were satisfied there. They didn't look, didn't feel different. They didn't smell different. Couldn't figure that out. Evidently, there was a greater force at work than the forces that God set up for creation. They said, you know, the creation obeys me. Fire did not burn them up. Fire did not do anything to them. They could walk right to work and nobody would know the difference. Their clothes were fine, their hats, their turbans that they were wearing, or their robes. Not a problem. Which is a powerful image. And you can see that Nebuchadnezzar makes some conclusions there. Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach. This is verse 28. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants, they trusted in him and defied the king's commands, my commands, and they were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God, with a capital G. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way. And he promoted them even to higher government jobs in Babylon. Pretty interesting stuff. Now you notice what King Nebuchadnezzar did not say, which is kind of an important thing. He made conclusions about the angels. He made conclusions about their God being a very, very powerful God. But he did not say, I am not God. That is the God. But he recognized the authority of something that he had never seen before, which is a turning point for Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, that's really coming quite a ways. He does say, don't mess with the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So this is Babylon in the Bible, larger than life. You know, the Tower of Babel going back to Genesis. This was used, Babylon was used as the archetype of any kingdom gone bad all the way to the book of Revelation. You see that. It was the example of human kingdoms that go wrong. And it's a kingdom in rebellion to God. And again, it's that expose of kingdoms that are in error, or kingdoms that are going against what God would have them do. Now, what are we to do as God's people? So what's the message for us here today? That we can jump into a fiery furnace and not be burned? I don't think so. What are God's people to do? If you are over 18 years old, and I saw this statistic and I was like, wow. If you're over 18 years old, you were born in the century that saw more humans killed by humans than any other century in the history of the world. In the 1900s, it was the bloodiest century in terms of scale and proportion of human loss of life. How did that happen? How does that happen? In large part, it happens because human beings exalt themselves into the place of God. They elevated themselves where they shouldn't be elevated. Daniel 3 is our problem today. So what do we do today as Christians? What do we do? I think there's a couple of things. Based on the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it seems so simple but very powerful. Number one is to try to resist the temptation to equate your nation's value and elevate it above God's value. And how is that? If you think about it, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not take to the public protest. They didn't show up with signs saying, "Down with idols on the plain of Dura." You know, they didn't march on the plain of Dura with these placards and saying all that. They didn't withdraw to Waco, to some commune where they hid themselves away. In fact, they were fully engaged in Babylonian society. They were officers in the country. They were held in high esteem. And how did they resist? They just chose not to participate. How many times have you chosen not to participate in the culture that's around you? Just simply don't participate. Don't participate in it. If it's causing you a problem, if it's causing you to stumble, don't participate in it. Now, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have been fine just doing what they were doing. They didn't participate in the worshiping of the idol. But they were ratted out. And so they were brought before the king. But up until then, it was just a non-participation. They weren't drawing attention to themselves. They weren't strapping themselves with bombs and running out to the plain of Dura and threatening to blow themselves up next to the statue, right? That would have been easy for Nebuchadnezzar because he said, "I just kill you before you kill me," right? What does that do? That wasn't the answer. The power for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was in their innocence. Which is exactly what the power of the cross tells us, in the innocence of Jesus, where they stood there and they said, it doesn't matter what you do as a human. It doesn't matter. These kingdoms are futile without God. And that was where their power was. You can kill us. Doesn't matter. If you kill us, it doesn't make you God. It doesn't change you at all. So because they're not a threat to Nebuchadnezzar, that was where their power was. Kind of an interesting thought. So that's one way that we can do that. We can just not participate. We don't have to withdraw. But here's the thing. We live in a country where our mission is to seek God's kingdom and love God and love other people. My motivation to do that is not because I'm an American, not because I live in the USA, not because I believe that my country is the best country on the earth. But I believe that the country exists under the rule and authority of God, which is good, and I am called to contribute as an image-bearing creature, as a human follower of Jesus. That's who I am. That's where my responsibility is. I love this picture. On December 24th, 1968, up until that time, it was like, and I vaguely remember this when I was a kid. I wasn't even like quite 10 years old. But this was Apollo 8. It was the first time that human beings had ever seen the Earth rise. And it rose over the horizon of the moon. And the astronauts were Jim Lovell, Frank Borman, and Bill Anders. And when they saw that, here's what they said. And it was the broadcast on television, the most watched broadcast. You might remember this. And James Lovell said, "We're now approaching the lunar sunrise. And for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message we would like to send you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light. And God saw the light, and it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness." James Lovell went on to read the next few verses in Genesis chapter 1. And Frank Borman concluded after saying, "And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas." It was on Christmas Eve. "And God bless all of you on the good earth." They looked at this scene and thought how small they were and how powerful God was. And that was their response. Now, of course, Madeleine Murray O'Hare tried to sue the U.S. government for allowing the Bible to be read on television, and that didn't go anywhere. The Supreme Court threw it out. There's always going to be challenges. The current's always going to be flowing. This would have been a cool passage to read, too, from Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. And it sums it up with this: "The Son, S-O-N, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and things on the earth, visible and invisible, whether they are thrones, kingdoms, powers, rulers, or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." And as you look at the earth and you think about that in reference to Jesus, it's a pretty powerful representation of what our citizenship means, to be citizens of humanity created in the image of God, set here to rule by loving God and loving other people, and called to bring out the best in whatever is around us as citizens of this nation. It doesn't fit neatly into any of the boxes. It doesn't fit into the Republican. It doesn't fit into the Democrat. You can identify with either party, and you can find ways to say, "Yeah, I do." And it's fine, absolutely fine. And we should exercise our responsibility to vote, because God has given that to us. Please, please vote. But when we elevate our ideology and our politics above what's important to be citizens of humanity through Christ and his redemptive power, then we have trouble. Then we have problems, because then it's all bets are off. And in the end, we know from reading our Bible that every knee will bow and confess what? Yeah. I want the bad guys to confess now. But I need to remember that I need to be able to save them, so that when they do see that, they can confess with joy and not fear in their hearts. And that's my job. That's what I need to be focusing on. And unfortunately today, somebody told me this. They said, we have the idea that, you know, in the NFL, the Cowboys don't like the New York Giants. The Vikings don't like the Green Bay Packers. They want to beat them, but they don't want to put them out of business either. They need them, right? And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew that their allegiance was to God. But they also knew that they needed to bring out the best in the Babylonian kingdom that was around them. It's a fine edge to walk. And I'm glad that Jesus helps us walk that edge, that we can bring out the best in the Babylonian kingdom and not succumb to those other powers that are out there. So I would encourage you to do that and find ways this week to do that while we're swimming upstream, to bring out the best. You know, we need to stand up, and we need to disagree, and we need to take that stand. And last Tuesday night, Thomas and I had the privilege of going down to the Family Heritage Alliance banquet, and we heard Todd Starnes, who was a frequent guest, I think, on Fox News and has his own column and his own website and so forth. And he tells us the story about this marching band that was in Georgia. Remember the story he told us about that And I thought it was kind of a good story. And I don't agree, and I'll talk to you later about that if you want. Thomas and I can talk to you about, you know, but, I don't agree with everything that was said, you know, and the philosophies, but this I thought was pretty cool. There was a time about a year ago where the marching band at this Mississippi high school, I said, Georgia, it was Mississippi, they used the song How Great Thou Art in their halftime band presentation. Well, there were some complaints brought to a judge, and the judge said that the school could not perform How Great Thou Art during the halftime presentation last year during high school football games. And so their first game of the season, the home game of the season, came, and the judge said that we will fine you $10,000 if you do. And so the band director said, you know, we've already had enough problems with these people trying to stop school prayer at graduation and putting the Ten Commandments in the hallway at school that we don't need another $10,000 fine. We can't afford it. And so they just told the band, you can't play at halftime, because the band director said, well, if we can't do the songs that we normally would do, that we want to do, then we won't play. And it was sad because halftime came and it was just kind of silent. And people were kind of milling around, going to the concession stand, but there wasn't anything happening. One of the cheerleaders, about halfway through, stood up and started singing, Oh Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder. Then the cheerleaders picked it up, and then the people that were sitting behind them in the stands began to sing, and before long there were 10,000 people in that stadium singing How Great Thou Art. In their little silent protest. And one of the people that was there said, at that moment, I was proud of my town coming together and taking a stand for something we believe in. It breaks my heart to see where our country goes and getting farther from the Christian beliefs that our country was founded on. And this woman wasn't the only one who felt that way. Another one said, we may be pictured as toothless, barefoot, uneducated people around the country, and we're far from it. I'm from Mississippi. I'm not afraid to take a stand for God. And it was quite a sight. And federal Judge Reeves wasn't able to do anything. But the people that were against him said, this won't be the end of the story. So where it goes from here, we don't know. But it was one time where you stood in the furnace and there wasn't anything that the flames could do. And there wasn't anything that the authorities could do to stop 10,000 people from singing How Great Thou Art. Pretty cool story. And when it happens to you this week, do that. Take a stand. Thank you for staying overtime tonight, and I appreciate you being here. And let's close with prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for allowing us to study this important passage from Daniel chapter 3 to see the bravery and see the conviction, the courage of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I pray that we have that conviction to know that we can stand up for the things that we need to stand up for, to not participate if that's the simple choice that we need to make, just simply not participate. And if we're called out on it and we have to take that stand, that we can do it in a way that's polite and peaceful and in a way that shows courage and conviction at the same time that would inspire others, and help us to always be on the lookout for ways that we can bring out the best in our neighbors and our friends to further your kingdom here in the United States. Lord, I thank you for allowing us to navigate through a class on politics and religion and have that time that we can spend through your word together. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.